Let me direct you to Psalm 1, and you can look that up and follow along there. But before we get there, we have two other places that are short, and I think that I'll just read them for you so that you don't have to have your fingers stuck all over the scriptures, which is not a bad place to be stuck. But nonetheless, let me read these first two short sections for you, and then we'll read Psalm 1. The first is found in Proverbs 4, and this is what the proverbist says: "But the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn that shines brighter and brighter until the full day. The way of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know over what they stumble." And Psalm 119, verses 29 through 30, say this to us: "Remove the false way from me, and graciously grant me your law. I have chosen the faithful way. I have placed your ordinances before me." And then Psalm 1: "How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. And in whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish."
Now, tonight, we come to one of those hidden jewels in the book of Acts. And I say almost hidden, for the phrase that we come to tonight is hidden in just plain sight. The phrase seems so very natural in Luke's use of it that we hardly take notice of it. The story that Luke writes is so compelling that we sometimes miss some important details because we just are busy turning the page. The book of Acts is truly a classic page turner. Now, if you would, with me, just for a minute, turn to Acts chapter 9, which is where we'll start tonight. And we'll begin reading in verse 1. "Now Saul, breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked for letters from him to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, both men and women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. And it came about that as he journeyed, he was approaching Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. And he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?'" Now with that, we'll stop. And you say, "Don't stop. It's keep reading." But we're going to stop. Now the account is riveting. And as we read it, we are set on edge, to find out what will happen next. And if you want to, you can just skip to the end of Acts and you can find out what happened. But we won't do that. Tonight we are confronted from the very first that this dragon of a man who is breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the followers of Jesus, this fellow named Saul, this ferocious young man is tracking down the disciples of Jesus like his Old Testament namesake David did, Saul did centuries before with David. You remember? David says he was hunted down like a single flea. Now this, now modern day, Saul, is not content merely to suppress the ideas of this faction within the Jewish community that will ultimately be called Christians, but he has set himself against them in the most personal and violent manner. Men and women alike felt his wrath. Saul would later speak of those days, and he said this, "I persecuted this way unto death." Now we see this young and upcoming rabbinic Pharisee, Saul, is well connected. He has gone to the most important and powerful Jewish authority in Jerusalem to authorize his actions in persecuting the church. The high priest authority was vast and it reached across the Roman Empire. So here Paul, armed with letters from Jerusalem, he is on a hunt. And as we read, we are no doubt hurrying along to find out what will happen. Will Saul find his hunted prey among the 18,000 Jews living in the ancient city of Damascus? But notice how these beleaguered souls are described. If we read too fast, we will miss it. Saul was hunting those who were belonging to the way, or who were of the way. Did you notice the expression? If you did, raise your hand. Everybody's... Some of you are raising your hand. I really didn't mean you to raise your hand, but that was a rhetorical device. But some of you have noticed this expression, the way. I think it's delicious, really. It's a suggestive way to describe Christianity. Now, of course, this expression, the way, referring to the disciples of Jesus, predates the word Christianity. It won't appear until chapter 11. But let's take a brief tour in the book of Acts and hunt up these words or this expression, the way. It will appear again and again. It appears in Acts chapter 19 in the account of Paul's third missionary journey. Paul, for several months, was seemingly having good success in preaching in Ephesus. You probably all know this story, but Acts 19 reads this way. But when some were becoming hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the multitude, Paul withdrew from them and took away the disciples, reasoning daily in the school of Tyrannus, and this took place for 2 years, so that all who lived in Asia heard of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. God was doing a work, was he not? But that there's first some trouble in the synagogue, and they were speaking evil of the way. So we find this separation. Now the phrase appears again later in the chapter where Luke tells his readers that in spite of this early resistance, some of those in the synagogue at Ephesus, in spite of all that, the word, it says, the word of the Lord was growing mightily and prevailing as Asia heard the word. Now, at that time, there was success. But Paul finally decides to leave Ephesus. And as he's planning to do that, verse 23 reads, "There arose a disturbance." This is in verse 23 of Acts chapter 19, concerning the way. And you'll remember, that the silversmiths there in Asia were furious at what had happened. People stopped coming to the temple. They stopped buying trinkets made of silver of the goddess Artemis. And so there was a disturbance concerning the way. Now later in chapter 22, we find the third expression. This same expression will appear in verse 20, chapter 22, where Paul uses it of himself, and he's now in the temple in Jerusalem making his defense. You remember a riot? It seems like everywhere Paul went, there was a riot. But I'm telling you, God was moving. And so Paul, in the midst of that, makes his defense. And he stands there in the temple, and he tells them of his conversion, and he says this, "And I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons." And later, Paul will make his defense before the Roman governor, Felix. And he says this. Now, this is after the Jews had come down to speak to Felix. You remember the account. And Paul had been arrested. And he was there on the coast. And Felix makes a big show of things. And they're going to have a little mini meeting. And the Jews come and accuse Paul of all kinds of things. And this is how Paul begins his defense after the Jews accuse him. "But this I admit to you, that according to the way which my accusers call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is written in accordance with the law and to the prophets." So Paul uses this expression of the way. And Paul closes the account of this encounter with Felix with these words, "But Felix, having a more exact way, a knowledge of the way, put off Paul and his accusers, saying, when Lysias, the commander, comes down, I will decide your case." So this expression, the way, appears over and over again. And so that's our subject tonight. It's a long, hard way to introduce your subject. By the way, this expression defining the Christians, the way, does not appear in any other of the books of the New Testament, only right here in Luke's book of Acts. Now we find in this quick trip through Acts, and these casual references, the expression, the way, was one of the oldest designations of the church. In fact, it became obsolete relatively quickly. But to me, the expression is delicious. Now, taking note of this expression, one wonders how the word was taken up and used by the early church. Well, the Old Testament. You find again and again the idea of the way in the Old Testament. Steve read to you several of them just a while ago. But I'll give you a few more examples. Moses, praying to God, said this, "Now therefore I pray thee, if I have found favor in thy sight, let me know thy ways, that I may know thee, that I might find favor in thy sight." Job says this, and speaking of knowing God, Job says, "Behold, these are the fringes of his way. How a faint word I hear of him." The word, he just hears a little from God. But he speaks, listen, "Behold, these are the fringes of his ways." Do you think you know much about God? What we know is just the fringes of his way. I think Amy Carmichael has a little book called that. Am I right? The edges of his way. In the prophecies of Isaiah, God speaks through the prophet and says this, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts, than your thoughts." The psalmist says in Psalm 67, "God be gracious to us and bless us. Cause his face to shine upon us, that thy way may be known in the earth, thy salvation among all the nations." So this expression, the way, or God's ways, is very Old Testament. Should we not be surprised that the early church read the Old Testament and found ways of speaking to one another via the Old Testament? Now, finally, in the letter to the Hebrews, that author, we don't know who he is, Apollos, probably, quote Psalm 95, whoever wrote it. And he quotes that psalm, and this is what he says, "For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. Today, if you would hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as the day of Manasseh in the wilderness. When your fathers tested me, they tried me, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said they are a people who err in their hearts, and they do not know my ways." So we learn from these Old Testament passages that the concept of God's purpose for humanity is frequently expressed through this metaphorical device, this word, the path or the ways of God. Now, one final one. We have to go to Psalm 23. One final example. David says, "The Lord restores my soul, and he guides me in the paths or the ways of righteousness for his name's sake." And so this concept of a path laid out before us and as God's plan for our life is Old Testament. And you could see why the early church would take it up as a term of self-designation. But let me just say this. As we ponder this metaphorical device and this term, the way or the paths of God, we see it that the Old Testament people saw these paths as their ultimate good. To be on that path is where good would come. And to be a part of that, apart from that path, that's when you were in danger. to not know God's ways is when something truly bad would happen. But also, as we read the Old Testament, we see that God's ways are beyond human criticism and understanding, and that we must therefore humble ourselves reverently before God. God's ways are not our ways. Do you really get that? Humankind is not naturally disposed towards God. His ways are different from our ways. God will do things differently the way than what we would do them. So, and his ways are beyond criticism. And the Jewish people understood that. The Old Testament is rich as it describes and contrasts God's ways and our ways. Old Testament writers confess that God's ways were not readily understood by men. And they ultimately were like in the sea, and they were past finding out. His thoughts were not our thoughts. And in acknowledging this, they sought to approach life with a bit of humility that acknowledged that God's ways were perfect, and it's our duty to follow with resolute hearts, that acknowledge in all circumstances that we not lean into our own understanding, but lean upon God in faith. If you must understand, you will not follow long. I look around the room, and I know most of you would say, I understood very little when I started on this path of Christianity. And if God had explained everything to you back then, you would have said, no, wait a minute. But graciously, you didn't insist on it, for sure. We just must be humble before Him. Now, as we look into the New Testament, we have two passages that might suggest why the early church took up this expression, the way. But before we do that, the very idea of discipleship suggests that the following of a teacher or a rabbi's instructions as a pattern for life's journey is just apparent. You are a disciple of someone, and that means you are a follower. And the follower, and the idea of following means there's action involved. You are following along in a path. So the word discipleship kind of has the expression, the way in it, logically. Now, as we look at the New Testament, there are two passages that I'm going to get to that suggest why the early church took up this phrase, the way. The first one is Matthew chapter 7, verse 13 through 14, where Jesus instructs His disciples. This is I'm pretty sure it's only in Matthew, but don't hold me, my feet to the fire. That may not be right. Matthew chapter 7, verse 13 and 14. If you have a good Bible reference there, it'll say, no, this is in Luke 2 or Mark. I don't know. But it's in Matthew, so I'm going to read it. And you're looking at me like, well, then read it. This is what Jesus says. Enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And many are those who enter it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. and few are those who find it. Now, this passage is very clear. You and I are constantly being confronted by choices. These choices are metaphorically presented to us as two different paths that one might follow. One path leads to life. The other path leads to tragedy. And often the path of life at first appears as difficult and tedious, which belies the fact that it is in all actuality the path towards life. One path is narrow and small and looks like a alleyway. But the path leads to life. While the other path, the path of tragedy, at first seems tree-lined, like a tree-lined boulevard, like that place in Paris. It's broad and wide. And it appears like a path of ease and comfort, while all along it's just the opposite of what it appears. Is this sobering? Isn't it amazing how Jesus' words are so authentic and just magnificent? As we look at these two paths, the application is simple enough. But in all actuality, these two paths are not clearly marked with road signs and flashing lights. In fact, the paths seem to hardly diverge from one another at the beginning, but in the end, the path we choose is all important. And let me tell you, life is full of such choices. We don't see the markers, or, you know, it'd be good to, how can you find a young Christian starting off in life and you say, now I want you to write down every choice you make from now until you're 78 years old when you die. I want you to keep a list of them, every choice you make. And probably, if a guy did that, there would be thousands of little choices of which path to take, the path of life that seemed narrow and hard to deal with, or the path that looked glorious that would end in death. We all experience this choice often. And I think the passage here in Matthew is a passage about a path. And that Christians have chosen a way. And they are acknowledging by this term that they have chosen the way of life. And it may get you in trouble. You may appear before Felix. Who knows what will happen? Now, then we come to John chapter 14. Verse 6, and this passage probably is more pivotal in this, on the reason why the church would choose this expression as the way for themselves. And it's probably the most influential of all. The early church would, of course, gravitate to Jesus' words spoken to Thomas. Do you remember what they were? I bet you all can quote them. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Here is an amazing declaration. Jesus says, I am. And what follows is unique. What follows that, I am, is unique. There is no equivalent in religious history of what Jesus was getting ready to say. So the idea in verse 6, I am the way. And then the way is explained in absolute terms. I am the way, the truth, the life. To expand on the thought, it might be understood in this matter. I am the path to the truth. I am the truth. I am the path to life. I am life. And there's only one approach to the Father, that is by me. Jesus makes it's an unequivocal statement. It's one of those statements that you can't get around. It is a purely Christian statement. And so it seems natural enough that the early Christians would take this phrase, the way, as a term of self-designation. We are of the way. What way? The way of Jesus. What path? The path of life. What path? The path of truth. Where is that path? It's Jesus. It's just one, almost circular. Now, the application in all this, Jesus' statement as recorded in John is simple enough. In finding Jesus, we find the path that we were always intended to find. In Jesus, we found our person, our reason for existence. This is the path that I was intended for. Now, I'm going to use a silly example. I used to be a lawn boy. I was a good lawn boy. Greg knows it. We both did it together. And I sometimes thought, how did I find myself here? But you know, I followed God to that point. Step by step. And when I finally found myself at that point, I had, as I was looked back at it, I was in the way. Isn't that sweet? In the light of Jesus' unequivocal statement, it seems natural enough that the early Christians take this expression unto themselves. Now, if these things are true, in finding Jesus, we find the path that we were intended to take. In finding Jesus, we find the truth and all that the word truth stands for. Lies and subterfuge disappear in His presence. Reality shines forth in blinding glory. And in finding Jesus, we find life. Death and sorrow is just strewn about us. We walk through it. But we nevertheless walk in life. Do you see this world is strewn with death on every side? It is. But you walk in life. Isn't that a glory? And so in the end, this is the application. We must set about that path purposefully. The path of Jesus. Choosing each day that this path is our greatest good, no matter how it might lead out at first. Now, this last week, as I studied this subject of the way, I found in, I came across this German word, and I'm going to do my best. And you know I get tongue-tied up here because I get rattled. I look at you, and y'all are all looking at me like. So I'm going to try to pronounce a German word. My wife is laughing at me. The word is Wandertagkalismus. How's that, honey? She thinks she knows German. She does Duolingo. Any of y'all do Duolingo? Well, these people that do Duolingo think they know language. Anyway, she taught me how to say Wandertagkalismus, okay? It's a great word. Now, the Germans are crazy about throwing together several words to create one new word. They just do it all the time. Greeks like that a little bit. They put words together. Wandertagkalismus. I'm getting good at it. You say it fast and with authority, like Hebrew. Now, the word originally was created by those Germans to speak of traveling Christian teachers and prophets in the early church era. The idea was a throwback to the Jewish culture. You remember how Paul the Apostle goes to a synagogue and they see Paul there and they say, "Brother, do you have something to say?" And Paul had something to say. But there was a common thing among the Jews that you'd have traveling rabbis appear periodically and they would speak. The early church had some of this among them. And that's where this word Wandertagkalismus came from, this German word. Now, I say all this for a reason, so you'll laugh at me. So I'll get to my point. The word Wandertagkalismus is translated from the German into English by this phrase: travel radicalism. Doesn't that sound like German? The Germans would say that. Travel radicalism. I like the English side. I understand that. Now, not knowing this, the technical term and its meaning, I thought it might be a wonderful word to apply to Christians. So I misused the term and interpreted it the way I wanted to. They considered it one way, but I like the word travel radicalism. For in this life, are we not all travelers of sorts? I'll say it one more time. In this life, are we not all travelers of sorts? Our lives are not our own. I used to think, why did I become a pastor? I mean, everybody else does what they want to. Why do I have to seek the will of God? Do you ever feel that way? Steve doesn't, but I used to. Why am I stuck with trying to figure out what God's will? Everybody else gets the job they want or does what they want or, kicks the dog if they feel like it. And if I kick the dog, I feel bad. They don't feel bad. You see my point? It doesn't apply just for preachers. All of us are in a way. All of us are responsible to follow the path of God. I like this, travel radicalism. We are on a path to life, to heaven. That is our destiny. But in the meantime, we are responsible for doing the will of God and being in the will of God. Is that true? I'm not going to ask anybody to say amen, but it is true. There is a radical aspect to the Christian following the path of God. It's radical. We are all travelers of sorts. Are we not all on the path to God? And God is Himself the path. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Now I latched on to this word, travelical radicalism. And I'm going to keep it in to myself from now on out. But I like the expression. You are on a path one way or the other. Either it's the path to life or it's the path to God. There's no, a path to death. It's one or the other. We are on a path. The idea of travel radicalism seems delicious. It suggests to me a life of adventure in our walk with God. Look, we wake up every day. Who knows what will happen? And we can be counted on, that we, in choosing the path of God, it will end well ultimately. And so the Christian, spoke of themselves as being in the way. They had embarked on a pilgrimage of sorts. Now our walk may be fraught with danger and deprivation, sometimes with heartache and failure. But even so, I'm telling you, our God is kind. In the midst of it, He doesn't kick us like I would kick the dog. He's kind. And He leads us in the way. The expression "in the way" is unqualified, and I like that. And so the expression "in the way" lends itself to being useful in describing a multitude of circumstances in which the Christian might find himself. Are you in the way? If you are, you can't define exactly how that might go for you or me. It's undefined. And so the expression "the way" is useful in describing the Christian life. So my question to you tonight, just as a simple application, is this way a path that you would choose for yourself? If I laid before you the way, would you choose it? Is it a path that you would recommend to others? Would you say, look, oh, no, to your friends and neighbors, your children, your wife or your husband, or then who knows? Would you recommend the way to them? Now, John Bunyan, you're probably ahead of me, well understood the expression "the way." And he well understood the idea of Christian pilgrimage. This travel radicalism. This path that we Christians must take. This path that we must follow. And I'm sure Bunyan wrote from personal experience as he penned these words. Listen to what it says about Pilgrim. No, pardon me, it's Christian. Christian went on, sometimes sighingly, sometimes comfortably. what will be our experience? Sometimes sighingly, sometimes comfortably, but in the end, it's life. It's the path of life. It's the path of truth. Lies disappear. Oh, Lord, make them disappear in thy truth. Lies. And I'm telling you, folks, death is across this earth more than we realize. It's all about us. One day, it will all be swallowed up and life will come. You look at the soil in my garden and it's based on death, decaying organic matter. Dead leaves, dead biological organisms, death, death, death everywhere. The oil that we pump out of the ground to power our cars, death. I'm speaking of what oil is actually made up of. I'm telling you, life is coming. And we will not believe the glory of it. So we have a choice this day. I tell you, it's life. Was it Pilgrim or Christian? He ran through the gate or outside the city of destruction. Let me get it right. What did he cry? Life, life. And I'm convinced that that life will be so glorious, we cannot, and it is so glorious, we cannot speak of it. So that's the way.